Electrician number 11245, reel 5.
Mr. Goldsworthy, reel 5.
It was in mid-1949 that I was given my first long foreign assignment out in Hong Kong. I had to take the place of Sydney Smith, who had... I was to replace Sydney Smith, the Daily Express staff reporter in Hong Kong, who had gone up to Shanghai at the time of the China Civil War and had then been unable to get back to Hong Kong. The at that particular time, the big story that was in everybody's mind was the fate of the British frigate Amethyst. Now, Amethyst was taken its place in naval history, was sent in to go up the Yangtze to Nanking to replace another frigate up there, which was in attendance on the British embassy. Full point. The situation was that the China Civil War was still in full flight, and the Chiang Kai-shek forces had been pushed south to south of the River Yangtze by the communist forces. At the time that Amethyst was sent up there, she was supposed to have a safe conduct. But by the time this took place, the communists were already on the northern bank. And she, when the ship was some 140 miles, remember, not something like the distance from London to Manchester, up the river, she came suddenly under fire from communist guns on the northern bank. The result was that the ship went out of control, ran up onto a mud bank, and was suffered very considerable casualties. In fact, the captain was fatally wounded. There were altogether 20 men killed and 31 wounded. It was possible for the wounded to be taken out down along the south bank to Shanghai. But there still remained 80 men on board Amethyst. All this had taken place long before I went out there. The original captain having been killed, his place was taken by Lieutenant Commander John Cairns, who was an assistant naval attaché at Nanking, full point. He went down to find the situation for the ship, and being the senior officer, was ordered to take charge as the new captain. The problem was that the communists were claiming that the ship had invaded communist territory illegally. They wanted a specific admission that the ship had opened fire first and that it had no right to be there. This admission simply could not be made. Consequently, things dragged on and on and on. While conditions became very uncomfortable in the ship, but they were short of food, they were short of oil, and so on. And now I came back into this story in beginning of August. By that time, I had been keeping contact constantly with the Navy, and I had an invitation to go out in the over the August bank holiday weekend with a little group of HDMLs, that's Harbour Defence Motor Launches, who were taking with them a number of local businessmen to give them a little bit of experience in handling small craft, just in case the colony had to be evacuated and there was going to be a need for ferrying people out to ships and so on. Well, this was to be a Saturday, Sunday, Monday trip, so I agreed to go because the local naval authorities wanted me to write something for the English language papers out there. But I first of all had to make it quite clear that if there were any messages from London for me, they would be radioed out to me. Well, we went off on the Saturday morning, and that afternoon we did a little bit of there were three of the these little vessels, and we did some elementary navigation, ship handling, and so on, and then finally put down a hook and had got out the cards and finally went to sleep on deck. A beautiful night. And that night, Cairns decided to come down the River Yangtze into his place in even in English history. It was not until next morning when a message came from the other another one of the HDMLs, which had the radio watch, and I saw the light blinking out, and the message was, Goldsworthy is to be landed at once, reference Amethyst escape. Now you can imagine what a shock that was. We were well up the coast, but fortunately we were going in to meet a late arrival from the beach. And so I got into the boat, was rowed ashore, and the people who had brought him up by car took me back into Kowloon and back to the Hong Kong Islands. It was what had happened was that when Amethyst was partway down the Yangtze, and remember this was going to be a 7-hour trip at the end of 100 days of siege, during which they'd had continuously had communist guns targeted on them if they made a move. Halfway down, it was... Cairns signalled 100 up, and it was decided to announce to the world that Amethyst was making a break for it. Amethyst still had to pass the big guns at Wusong, so it was never sure that she was really going to breach the open sea. But I think the thinking on it was, let us show an effort rather than we have to wait until there's a disaster. So it was decided to announce the ship was on its way down the Yangtze. Now this was somewhere about 8 o'clock in the evening London time, still in time for the newspapers. But early morning, of course, in the Far East. So they rang the three main agencies, the Associated Press of America, the United Press of America, and the Reuters. There was no answer from the offices, the Hong Kong offices of AP and UP, but there was a clerk on duty in Reuters. And the clerk said, well, I can't do anything about this. You better ring our reporter, Monty Parrott, and gave them his home number. Monty Parrott was woken from a deep sleep, with a voice which said, this is the Navy speaking. We've got an announcement to make. The under heavy fire, HMS Amethyst is now making a run for the sea. She has already travelled 100 miles down the river. Monty Parrott put down the phone and thought, crikey, I've been dreaming. Rang them back and said, did you really ring me? And they said yes, and they confirmed it, and that's how Reuters got a scoop. Anyway, this was one of the great stories told amongst newspapermen. Anyway, by the time I got back, I was told that the cruiser Jamaica would be going in 2 hours' time to beat the Amethyst, and in the meantime, if I went across to the command headquarters, I could see all the signals overnight, and I went there and bashed out a, I always travel with a portable typewriter. I bashed out a cable for London, and then we sailed off to meet the Amethyst. It was somewhere off the coast of Formosa, I think, that the actual rendezvous came on the Monday evening. And there were a party of six newspaper men, AP, UP, Reuters, the Lockie MacDonald of the Daily Mail, somebody from the South China Morning Post, and myself. We were given very generous help from the radio messages and so on, and when we met the Amethyst, Lockie MacDonald and I were allowed to go across in the boat to meet and talk to the crew, which of course we did. That was the Monday evening. I then had an opportunity to take some pictures, first of all in the when we met the ship. I was up on the signal platform, and suddenly I realized that down below the Jamaica crew were lining the rail to cheer ship, and I realized that I could take a picture of the cheering crew or of the Amethyst, but I couldn't get them both in the same picture from there. So I scrambled down several decks in the last seconds and took a picture over the heads of the cheering sailors, and that picture really is the classic one which keeps coming up 40 years later whenever the Amethyst story is retold. And then while we were across visiting the ship, I took a picture of the crew lining the rails, who were absolutely laughing with sheer pleasure at the prospect of getting their first mail for 6 weeks. They'd been 100 days up that river under great tension. And so you can imagine the sort of emotional impact of their first contact with another ship in the Navy. That was Monday night. Tuesday we were sending quite a lot of stuff back from the Jamaica. And I was thinking in terms then of how we're going to get the pictures back. This may surprise people in days when television will bring pictures across the world instantly. But at that time, the only way to to transmit them by radio from a limited number of stations. And there was no picture transmission in Hong Kong, and the nearest I knew of was in Singapore, some 1,900 miles away. Well, the AP man told me that there was also a picture transmitter at Manila in the Philippines. And so while still in the Jamaica, I got the ship's photographic firm. Most of the big ships had sailors who made a hobby of developing and printing other people's pictures. I got them to develop the pictures I'd already taken and give me three prints of each. And I signaled the our stringer, our local representative in Hong Kong, asking when would there be a flight from Hong Kong to Singapore or to Manila. The reply after our due arrival on Wednesday morning, the reply was that there was no flight to Singapore until Friday, but there were flights to Manila in the afternoon, in the morning and the afternoon of Wednesday, the day we were arriving. That arrival in Hong Kong was a great emotional experience. It brings a lump to my throat and tears to my eyes when I think about it even now. We had the privilege of joining the Amethyst crew of 80 for the run up the harbour. Every ship in the harbour was hooting. There were fire floats outside with their hoses. Great jets of water. The crews of two cruisers were lining the rails to cheer us on our way. The army was out, lining up the hilltops. All along you could see the silhouettes of soldiers. The governor of Hong Kong was there with a guard of honor. It was just something that you really had to experience, to feel that this was such a moment for these lads who, as again must emphasize again, had been 100 days isolated from the rest of the Navy.
This was a feeling of indignation as well about the action of the communists in holding the ship.
There was a feeling, because this had been worldwide. There was a good deal of indignation, too, at the way the Chinese communists had played a sort of cat-and-mouse game with these lads who were under their noses and had no real prospect of being released, and for these 100 days, for more than 3 months, they had been the subject of news stories all over the world, and the fact that they had now put up two fingers to the communists and got out despite all the risks of the 140-mile trip down the river was really something that lifted the hearts of the whole British nation. Anyway, when we went alongside, I I had an opportunity then to take a couple of pictures, first of the tattered white ensign still flying at on the ship with quite a clear evidence of the holes from the original shelling. And I had a chance too to take a picture of Cairns with the loudspeaker to his mouth giving the final order as we moved in close alongside the dock at Hong Kong with the governor and all the guard of honour drawn up down below. But taking pictures is one thing, getting them back to Fleet Street is another. And we were within 50 minutes of the time of the first Manila flight of the day. So I ran down to the waterfront, took a water taxi across to Kowloon and a taxi out to the airport with the first two pictures in an envelope addressed to press radio in Manila. Managed to find an airline official who was going there who agreed to take it for me. So that was the first two away. But the others were still in the camera and I took them to a local photographer's and said, I want three prints of each of these pictures within a couple of hours. And he said, not possible. I said, but I must have them. I don't care what it costs me. I must have them before this afternoon flight. Oh no, he said, no, it is not possible. So I said, well, why not? He said, because there would be no time to fix them. They would fade. And I said, well, how soon would they fade? He said, perhaps within a month. I said, if they don't fade before tomorrow, I don't care a bugger this. Just get them printed. So anyway, we managed to get them printed and away on the second flight. And that evening, I was in the South China Morning Post office, the newspaper office, where our local representative worked, when a message came back from the United Press man in Manila to say that the picture transmission facilities there had closed down 2 weeks before. So in other words, all the effort to get it to Manila and meant nothing because it was going to be 2 days flight on to San Francisco. In desperation, I was thinking, was there any other way? And I looked again, and that night I was looking at the proofs of next day's aircraft movements, just in case there was some other way we could channel it. And there amongst the aircraft movements for Thursday morning, there was BOAC to Singapore. So I rang up the airport and said, what time is this flight to Singapore tomorrow? And they said, there is no flight to Singapore tomorrow. Nothing till Friday. I said, well then, it's amongst the aircraft movements. Why, what is that? Well, I don't know about that. They said, it's certainly not... we have no flight to Singapore tomorrow. So, they said, well, if you don't believe me, I'll put you through to operations. I said, yes, put me through to operations. And I spoke to operations, and they said, yes, I know what you're talking about. This is the new Argonaut service. This is a crew familiarization flight. I'm sorry, sir, you can't travel on that. It's not in service. So I said, I don't want to travel on it. I want to send an envelope. And they said, well, I'm afraid you couldn't do that either because there's no manifest. It just doesn't exist commercially. So I went across to Kowloon to the Peninsula Hotel, which is the base for the airlines, and saw the clerks there and said, could I send this envelope, by which time I had, of course, four pictures already to go, on the Singapore flight. And they said, no, sorry, we haven't got a manifest. It's nothing to do with this commercially. It's just an internal familiarisation for the flu, for the crews. So I tried and pleaded, but no, there was no moving them. So I waited till 4:30 in the morning when the crew came down. And I said to them, would they be kind enough to take this for me to Singapore and they would be met and so on and so on. No, no, I said, they'll know this carrying private mail over international boundaries is a crime in civil aviation. It's just a thing you're not supposed to do. So I pleaded and pleaded with no luck, and they said, well, the captain's coming down shortly, but you can have a word with him. But he's usually bloody-minded at this time of the morning. Sure he was. He went and took a separate table from his crew, and when I spoke to him, he said, oh, no, he said, why should I help the Daily Express? You're only trying to scoop your rivals, and you're always criticising BOAC. And I said, look, this is the biggest boost for morale for the British nation for years, and I just want to get these to Singapore. And finally he said, well, he said, if you can get it on the manifest, I'll take it, but otherwise I won't touch it. So I went back to the clerks, and they still wouldn't chiff. And then they did mention the English freight manager was coming in to see some other aircraft off. So I went to him, and I showed him the pictures, and I showed him the thing was unsealed, it would be met at the other end, and he took it, and I can always remember, he said, Amethyst, that's different, we'll open the manifest. And that brand new airliner went off 1,900 miles, with only one, no passengers, no freight, and one item on its manifest, which was my envelope, which cost 7 shillings and 6 pence. So that's 3 Hong Kong dollars, 1,900 miles to Singapore. And that day, of course, I was sweating blood to know whether they'd been picked up and taken to Cable and Wireless. And by evening, I got the Cable and Wireless in Hong Kong to call their mates in Singapore, confirmation it had been received and transmitted. And that night, I had 4 ecstatic cables from London, because we had a complete world scoop. Everybody else was waiting for Friday morning. And that was one of the days you live for if you're a newspaper man. All of which is getting us rather away from the Amethyst.